Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by The Sinner. From executive producer Jessica Biel, The Sinner is a limited series event that begins with an unsettling and heart-wrenching crime, parents murdered by their young son. But the sins of a child are never his alone, and beneath the surface of a seemingly normal small town lie very dark secrets. You will know who, you will know how, but you won't believe why. Bill Pullman, Carrie Coon, and Tracy Letts star. The Sinner airs Wednesdays at 10, 9 central on USA Network.
Hello, still watching listeners. This is Joanna Robinson with a quick little note for you. The very beginning of this episode, we have a slight little technological issue with the sound, but it smooths out really quickly, and the rest of the episode does not have that problem. So do not despair. Stick through the first 30 seconds or a minute or so, and then you will be rewarded with much smoother audio. Thanks so much, and enjoy. Hello and welcome to Still Watching, Fall TV Preview Edition. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
For the next few weeks of this podcast, Richard and I are going to be taking a look at a few shows that we are excited about that are new and premiering, and a few shows that we are still watching from previous seasons. Just basically some series that we wanted to highlight sort of week by week. We might also, as is our wont, include some interviews with people who are working on these shows. But as for this week, we wanted to dive into one of Richard's favorites from last year, which is the Netflix series Ozark. It just dropped its second season on the platform last week. It's about 20 episodes, 10 episodes per season. You can stream the whole thing. We're not going to get too spoilery about this, Richard, right? We just sort of want to talk about why we think this is a show worth your time in the, like, super crowded TV landscape. Why should people watch Ozark? So I just want to start by asking Richard, like, what other shows would you compare Ozark to?
I mean, I think the obvious comparison is Breaking Bad, just because it's about, like, a seemingly normal, you know, well, guy, and also his family, or his wife at least, who, like, finds himself in a criminal enterprise, and it gets deeper and deeper into it. So that's probably the closest comparison, but, like, it's also, like, one of those shows that in this sort of prestige television era where, like, they're like, oh, we haven't, there's not a show set in this world. So it's very much like a show about a place. I sometimes wish it was more about the place, but yeah, I think it's solidly entertaining as a thriller. It has some great acting, some really interesting filmmaking, often at the hands of Jason Bateman, who is the star and also directs a lot of the episodes. So, I mean, it has a lot. It's probably my, like, dad-ist show that I like.
Yeah. it's very dad show. I call the dad genre as, like, the epitome of the dad genre for me is Ray Donovan. That is, like, the epitome of a dad show for me. So I hadn't watched this show before we decided to talk about it. So I have since seen all of season one and some of season two. And I guess, yeah, I should, lay out the premise really quickly, which is Jason Bateman plays Marty Bird, investment guy, genius who gets involved with with the mob and washing their money. The lovely Laura Linney plays his wife, Wendy Bird. He's got two kids, Charlotte and Jonah. And, you know, as the series kicks off in season one, they relocate from Chicago to the Ozarks, which are called the Redneck Riviera, I guess, in Missouri. And so the show takes place, as you say, Richard, like the place, the location is so distinct, and it's like right on the water in the Ozarks. So it's this sort of resort town where there is a lot of money, but it's very much intermingling with a lot of like, the self-described rednecks. So, that is the interesting locale. There are a few actors, that we should, you know, sort of note. I mean, we talked about this when we did Westworld. I had asked you sort of what your experience with the actor Peter Mullen was. And you were like, oh, he's on Ozarks. Pretty great there. And now I see what you mean. He plays like one of the show's many big bads, but basically like I completely agree with you about Breaking Bad. Because this is a show where Marty and his wife and the various other operatives, like, just when you think they're going to escape whatever noose is around their neck, another noose tightens and they're drawn into something else. And basically, like, Marty has an ever shifting goal line of an amount of dollars he has to wash, like, make clean for the mob. And it's constantly moving, or he's constantly losing some of the money and gaining it back, and sort of like for some reason I kept thinking of Into the Woods, where they're like, oh, they almost have all the things they need. Oh, they lost the things and now they need more things. So,
yeah, the series has a real sort of like, I mean, I guess all shows do, or most shows do, but like the way that the Ozark, like the causality in it, you know, like one thing leading to this thing, and the kind of like, well, further deepening into this criminal enterprise, but also like, their sort of purview, especially in the second season, getting bigger, you know, because you have these, you know, Mexican drug cartels that they're washing money for, but there's also the local gangsters, you know, played by Peter Mullen and his associates. And naturally in the second season, other elements have to be introduced. So, I think that in the second season, it stays the kind of like taut, interesting little series it is in the first season, but it feels bigger.
When I was thinking of what shows I would compare it to, it all like led me back to a different era of me watching television, which is when I was watching Breaking Bad and Dexter and Justified and Sons of Anarchy and all of these like male, you know, classic male antihero, golden age of antihero and crime, but like highbrow crime sort of stories. I wanted to talk to you about the way in which the Jason Bateman casting is, I don't know, I think one of the greatest geniuses of the show is the use of Jason Bateman, who is an actor who has just like oodles of charisma, but has always, almost always, like from the beginning of his career, sort of struck me as slightly miscast, because I think he's often cast as, not always, but often cast as like the good guy. And here he's the good guy, you're rooting for him, but he's also a kind of a pretty bad guy too. And so that to me works with this like unmistakable sort of like smarm factor that Jason Bateman has, and I mean that as like a compliment. I really, really love what he does in this series. So I was just wondering, like, what you think of the Marty Bird as like a classic male antihero, and Jason Bateman in that role?
Yeah, I mean, I think he's well cast because like, you know, there are a lot of scenes where Marty has to kind of quickly kind of summon his courage and convince a really bad guy, like, not to kill him or his family because, you know, here's X, Y, Z, here's how I can do it for you. You know, cause he's like, he's an accountant, like he has like solutions to things. And, I think that Bateman's energy works really well for that. There's a kind of like wily kind of, you know, scrappy quality to him.
Yeah.
That like the show necessitates, and is he's offset by Laura Linney as Wendy Bird, who it's, you know, it's a great role for her. She's, you know, movie work for her has, I feel like, not been great lately. And so it's fun to get to see her do her thing. And especially in the second season, I mean, Bateman's still, you know, front and center, I would say, but like, Linney gets a lot to do too, which is exciting.
Yeah, the second season moves further into the world of politics, or I guess at all into the world of politics. And the Wendy Bird character, and Wendy Bird is such a fun name, as is Marty Bird, by the way, but like Wendy Bird with all its like Peter Pan associations, but like Wendy Bird's history in politics comes to the fore, and it's like, they already knew what to do with her in season one. It never felt like they didn't know what to do with Laura Linney, but now it just, she just has even more agency. And the thing I love about her character, as opposed to like all those other male anti-hero shows that I listed, is like usually the formula in those male anti-hero shows like Breaking Bad or Dexter or Justified even is that you needed the female character to sort of either be one you're keeping a secret from or a nag or a wet blanket. And as a result, like, you know, famously with Breaking Bad, the bad fandoms sort of wound up hating those characters, wound up hating the character of Skyler White in Breaking Bad because she was ruining all the fun for Walter White. And that's obviously something that, like, I never got behind that fandom for doing that. But I also really disliked the various show writers for putting all their female characters in that position.
Yeah. And interestingly, I think in season two of Ozark, without spoiling anything, like, Wendy sort of seems to kind of be taking to this new life more than Marty is, even though he's the one who kind of basically got them into it. So there's kind of an interesting flip, I guess, that's similar to maybe something on The Americans, a show I haven't watched. I know I should, but like my understanding is that Carrie Russell's character is kind of the more committed to the cause one.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that's kind of an interesting thing. You know what, actually, I just thought about, another kind of similar show, I mean, not in tone at all, but in plot, is Schitt's Creek.
Yeah.
People go to a small town, they don't want to be there. And Schitt's Creek, which is very much about like building business, small business, it's always Ozark. So yeah, if you like Schitt's Creek, which everyone should be watching, by the way.
But you want more murder.
This episode is brought to you by The Sinner. From executive producer Jessica Biel, The Sinner is a limited series event that begins with an unsettling and heart-wrenching crime, parents murdered by their young son. But the sins of a child are never his alone, and beneath the surface of a seemingly normal small town lie very dark secrets. You will know who, you will know how, but you won't believe why. Bill Pullman, Carrie Coon, and Tracy Letts star, The Sinner airs Wednesdays at 10, 9 central on USA Network.
There was something, let me just say this about Ozark is like, I guess it always kept me guessing in terms of like where it was going to go in terms of violence and stakes, to the point that like something happens in the season one finale, and I won't say what it is, but something happened that I could not tell if a truly like really boundary breaking terrible thing was going to happen on the show or not. And that's the kind of show that it is. I was like, this show could go there. I could see the show committing to that. So it's just like, it's one of those things where like, you know, sometimes you're watching a show and you're like, oh, that's character safe, I'm not worried about them. And that's not how I feel ever when I'm watching Ozark. You know, I'm just like, I could see them killing literally anyone at any time if they so chose. So
yeah, no, I agree. I don't think it's any sign of my lack of investment, but you know, that like, yes, they could kill anyone, but it's not like a stressful show to watch, really. You know, there are moments of like tension, but like, you know, certain series, like I just find kind of like toward the end, I found Sopranos kind of agonizing because I was like, who's going to die? Like, I've been with these people for so long. I feel like Ozark is a little bit more casual, a little lighter than that. Which I appreciate.
Yeah, and it's also not like as tonally grim as like Bloodline, which I found to be a slog to watch, even though I like so many people on that show. I just couldn't get there with Bloodline. And this seems like a lighter version of that, perhaps because Jason Bateman's background is in comedy. So there are often these reactions he has to atrocious situations that are almost like a comedy. You know, he's playing it really low key, but almost like a comedy take. And that's probably why Breaking Bad worked as well as it did, because Bryan Cranston's background was in comedy. You know what I mean? And so it's just like, you've got a main hero who's not just like clenching their jaw, but they're like giving double takes sometimes, or, you know, whatever it is that really, serves the mood. And the other person I would attribute a lot of that tone to is Julia Garner, who plays this sort of young teen delinquent who Jason Bateman's character kind of takes under his wing begrudgingly at first, and then sort of more willingly. And Julia Garner, speaking of The Americans, like, she was fabulous in The Americans. She's really good in the upcoming Maniac, which will also be on Netflix. And she's just like one of those people who you can always recognize them because she's got this really distinctive curly mop of hair, but like, she's really very talented, in everything she's done. I know she's done a few films as well. And, I think she's a real standout on the show.
Yeah. I, her character's involvement in the world of the birds, strains a little credibility as the second season goes on, which kind of like harms, I think, my appreciation of the character. Mm-hmm. But like, she's good in it, and her arc in the first season is really interesting. It's an unlikely partnership between, you know, it's an unlikely partnership between her character Ruthie and Marty Bird. And it's a male female thing. It does not have a sexual component to it, which I appreciate. Also, if we're going to appreciate things, credit to the show for casting Linney, who is not only not 20 years younger than Jason Bateman, she's 2 years older than him, or at least, or maybe even more. So I think that's cool. They just got the best person for the job, no matter what, you know. And in season two, beyond Peter Mullen also joining the cast as kind of an antagonizer is the great Jana McTeer, who is, you know, an Oscar nominee for Tumbleweeds and Albert Nobbs, and has popped up in some television of late. And she's great in it. You've gotten to her episodes?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. She's amazing. Once again, it just kicked me back to those like old FX shows, like Justified or Terriers or something like that, where a new big bad shows up at the beginning of every season, and it's usually an actor you recognize, but not like a star, but like a journeyman actor that you're really excited to see them like just dig into this role. And so when she showed up at the beginning of season two, I was like, ah, yes, here we go, here it is. But the other thing that a lot of these shows, these like, family men plunged into crime or whatever it might be, bump up against is, obnoxious child actors. Mm-hmm. This has been a problem on some shows. I don't think it's a problem here, but I was just thinking of like some, you know, like The Americans did a pretty good job, but like famously Homeland bumped up against this problem. These kids really work for me. And, you know, and then they've got a few like counterparts, in the town. And here's the thing that made me feel like, I don't know. I was older than I wanted to be, which is that, Charlie Tahan, I think, mm-hmm. who plays Wyatt Langmore, who's got this like great, half up redneck hairstyle, was in the movie Charlie St. Cloud playing Zac Efron's like little ghost brother. And I was like, oh my God, it's the little kid from Charlie St. Cloud.
I recognize him from Love is Strange, the wonderful film with John Lithgow and Alfred Molina. But hey, we all have our points of reference.
Sure. Mine, I think, is equally as highbrow as that. But yeah, I was just like, oh my goodness. Anyway, yeah, I mean, like, I don't, what do you think of the kids on the show?
I think Skylar Gertner, who plays Jonah, the boy, I think he's good. I think his character remains interesting. No knock to Sophia Hublitz, who plays Charlotte, the daughter. Season two, she does some like angsty teen stuff that's like, wait, but your family is in mortal danger. Like save your kind of, you know, your, I feel like it's maybe like largely male staff not quite knowing how to write a teenage girl. Although they're doing a good job with Ruthie. So I don't know. But no, I think by and large, the kids are good actors. And that includes Charlie Tahan, and there's a couple other guys who play like his brothers or cousins or something. Yeah, it's a really well cast show. We should also mention Jordana Spiro,
yes.
From My Boys on TBS. I don't know if anyone watched that. I certainly did. And she's been in a lot of other things as well. She has an interesting role in the first season, and I don't think it's a spoiler to say in the second season. And she's really great, and it's interesting to see her in this kind of darker mode for those who, I mostly knew her from comedy.
No, that was one of those moments where I was watching her and I was like, whatever I know her from, it's light and she was blonde. I know that. I was like, it was like a fun light tone thing and she was blonde. And I looked up, I was like, oh my God, it's My Boys. So she's got like, you know, sort of shorter brunette, messy hair, and she's doing a great job. She's great in this role.
The show is intelligently cast. You know, I think that like, could it use more diversity? Sure. But, you know, et cetera, there are problems as there are with most shows, but like, I like that, everyone picked feels, and maybe this is a privilege of being on Netflix and you can just do this, but like everyone picked feels like they're there because they were the best thing for the role. It's not because they have a name or they're, you know, a Q score or whatever, you know, like none of the casting feels like stunty at all.
Yeah, I think especially the people that they cast to play, like the lifelong residents of, you know, the Ozarks,
mm-hmm.
are these people, these actors with just these like really lived in faces. You know what I mean? That it's just sort of like, I almost like there's a character in season one, who plays like Ruthie's uncle, who's got this like big ginger beard. And I was almost like, I was like, this guy has like such a great face. And I'm like, what else would I ever even put him in than this? You know, right. Like, and that is, I completely agree. It's like, you've got, obviously it's a little showy to have Jason Bateman in the lead. Like, this is a known and beloved TV and film actor. Laura Linney, like, gives the whole thing a lot of prestige. Absolutely. But other than that, all the casting, I agree with you, feels just very like, who is a character actor? Who fits this world? Who really works here? And I think to have someone even flashier show up, you know, there's a sort of, I don't know, political mover and shaker that shows up in season two, who's also like maybe a big bad figure. I haven't gotten far enough into season two to know, but he's played by an actor that I've seen in a few things, but like you know, he could very easily have been a name and he's not. And that's the kind of thing where you're just sort of like, okay, they've got Jenna McDear. Yeah, she's an Oscar nominee. But like, other than that, it's people that you can then just like disappear into the world. And that's what, you know, before Margot Martindale became like the character actress of our time, or at least tied for the character actress of our time, when she showed up on Justified season two playing Mags Bennett, like, I didn't know who she was. And I just was like enthralled by that character and that world. And then that's, I know I keep comparing it to Justified, but that idea of, we talked about this in Sharp Objects, whether or not Missouri is the South, but that idea of like a Southern-ish set crime show where you've got extreme wealth and extreme poverty and those two levels of crime sort of operating together, where you've got like, in Justified, you've got the like really low level oxy, you know, dealers, and then you've got like the high end political movers, and they're both equally villainous, and sort of to see the way these things operate. The same thing is happening over on the great Underwatch TNT show Claws, you know, where you just have these like two things coexisting. That really is an interesting commentary on like, you know, what people with money can get away with that people without cannot.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And all the sort of systems that are interlinked, you know, I think that one of the kind of like darker parts of this show is you see like I think I described it in my review of season two, that they're sort of this like they're an infection. Like they're like when the birds arrive in this town, they everything they do like ruins people's lives, you know, and I think that's, you know, people who are wealthy are harmed, and people who are poor are especially harmed, and just seeing how like what the ripple effects of something can be. And it's interesting because, you know, the initial ripple effect is that they're trying to stay alive, you know, so you're like rooting for them to like make it. But then you're like, oh, wait, but in their making it, they're causing harm to so many people. And how do you justify that? And how do you kind of, you know, and I think that Breaking Bad obviously gnawed at those questions in a way that I appreciated, but I think maybe got a little too grim for me or something, you know. And I think here, again, the tone is a little bit less, it's not quite as heavy, which I like, but while still also being thorough in its like look at what effect all of this is having in the community.
I mean, I loved Breaking Bad from start to finish, but Breaking Bad did eventually become like a stylized version of its first season, if that makes sense. Do you know what I mean? Like the iconography of Breaking Bad in the end almost overshadowed the actual human drama. And I think that Ozark, it's only in its second season, but Ozark is not a show that seems like it's going to go that way, even though it does have some like visual stylistic flair. And I want to talk to you about that. Like, so, Jason Bateman is nominated for an Emmy for directing, you know, some episodes as well as, in the lead actor category. And, I was wondering what you thought of the visual style of this show. I know a lot of criticisms have been that it is too, like, actually dark, like hard to see dark. It definitely has that like blue gray wash to the whole thing, but like what do you think of how the show looks?
I think it looks great. I mean, I think that like especially in season two, I think just, you know, because you're feeling a little more confident about, you know, you have a hit. I mean, we don't know Netflix's numbers, but I'm sort of told anecdotally that like Ozark is one of their bigger shows. You can start to do some interesting things. And I don't know if it's an episode he directed, but there's a really long shot of a motorboat going across the lake and it's Laura Linney on it with somebody else, and they're talking, and it's like very, very far away, and it's just this slow zoom in, and until they're actually like, you see that it is them in the boat. Like, it's a really kind of impressive thing. They do some cold open stuff this season that there's one in particular that goes backward in time that feels a little bit like, I don't know that we needed that, you know? But on the whole, I think it's a very slickly designed show. I guess my question is, does this series think that it's like high art prestige television or just really well-filmed kind of pulp? I think it's the latter, and that's fine. That's a perfectly fine thing to be. I just wonder sometimes how highbrow they think they are.
Yeah, there was another really good shot at the, I think it was the end of the season two premiere where, you know, Laura Linney and Jason Bateman's characters are, you know, in their finery coming back from this, you know, charity event that they've been to. And they took advantage of the house that they live in a way that they hadn't in season one, I think, because there's this long hallway that's all windows on one side. And they just did a shot of them from far away, like walking down that hallway, checking in on their kids while like sort of a piece of music that you wouldn't expect to play over sort of some of the grimmer things that happen in this series play. And it's that kind of little stylistic twist. Or there is this, I don't know how long it's been since you watched season one. For me, it was like yesterday, but, there's this episode in season one. I want to say it's episode 8 where it takes place, I don't know, 10 years, a decade ago, basically. Mm-hmm. And, or less than that, 2007 is what it was. And what's so fascinating about that episode is it's like, it's not completely uncommon for a especially a very complicated, entangled crime show to take one step back and be like, well, how did we all get here? Sort of thing. Like, right. That's not uncommon. But that episode itself is told completely out of order in a really fascinating way that I think challenges, like, just challenges as viewers. It's not going to hold your hand through this. And it's like, it's telling us an episode set entirely in the past, following, I think, like, 3 different storylines, basically. And they're not told in order. And that's just fascinating. Like, it feels like they put all the scenes in a bag and shook them up and just put them wherever they wanted to. And that's just like a very ambitious swing for a show that, as you say, like, I think is very glossy pulp, you know? So
yeah, no, they're trying stuff, and I appreciate that. And I think that hopefully, you know, if anyone listening to this is like now like, oh, maybe I'm going to watch it. Like, hopefully there's enough going on in the show to kind of let it stand out in, like you said, a very crowded field. But it's not so over the top and busy that like, it's just kind of like exhausting, you know? Like, it's not the Young Pope, don't worry. Like, in terms
yeah,
of style.
No, not at all. Yeah.
You know? And something I wanted to mention, I forgot when we were talking about cast, there were 2 other people on the show who probably bear mentioning. One is Jason Butler Herner, who plays an FBI agent who is kind of on the Byrds trail, sort of. Name's Roy Petty, which is a good name. They do some interesting things with that character, and that character does some interesting things with that guy with the red beard you mentioned.
I know. Yeah, I don't like to always pull the ask a gay card with you, but like, how do you feel about the way that gay love storyline, whatever you want to call it, in the first season is handled?
I think it's so interesting because I did not see it coming at all. I'm very much conditioned to not expect gay stuff in a show, in like a dad show like this, you know.
Right.
Though, you know, to Ray Donovan's credit and Billions' credit, they're actually are better at that stuff than I think they're going to be. But so I was surprised by it. That was the initial thing. And then it gets more complicated because the character, Roy Petty, like, he's probably the biggest antagonist in the first season, at least. And I think in the second too. And like, you know, and he's weird and he's maybe kind of a psycho and like, so you don't really like him and yet you're sort of into this relationship because it's something different. And like, the other guy's good. I don't know. So it's a really complicated, tricky thing. I guess you could maybe make the criticism of like, oh, why does the villain, you know, the gay guy have to be a villain or whatever, you know? But like, I think that like, it's interesting. It doesn't feel like a character decision that's there just to like fulfill a certain slot or whatever. It feels actually organic to the way that the character's drawn.
It's funny because like he's the villain, but he's the like he's the Fed, you know?
He's the law. Yeah,
he's the law. He has, I want to call it just a really interesting face.
Yeah.
And it's a face that I think you would usually cast him as, yeah, like a, I don't know, like one of the serial killers in Mindhunter. That's the kind of face I think he has. And so to put him in the Fed role, is really interesting. And he uses that face quite well. I think it is a really interesting, like, incongruous bit of casting. And then the fact that that storyline is complicated, I guess, or deepened, by his gay relationship with, like, one of the guys who lives in the Ozarks is, I don't know. I agree with you. I didn't see it coming. I guess that's the only spoiler, I guess, we're going to drop on this episode, is that there's a gay storyline in season one, but that's, I don't know. It's not a major twist, I think. But, I don't know. I thought it was, like you say, it was different, but like maybe we are just like thinking in antiquated, outdated ways about the way in which these dad shows treat sexuality. So.
Yeah. Oh, and it should be said that Jason Beller Harner was on some episodes of Ray Donovan. So,
sure was.
So there you go. And the other person I wanted to mention, I think you liked her too because she's in your show notes, is Lisa Emery, who plays Peter Mullen's character's wife. But she's not reduced to just like a wife role. She's actually kind of shown, especially into the second season, as the one who's actually in charge. And it's just a great performance from an actress who I don't really know, you know. I think she's mostly a theater actress, but I think she's such a fun addition to a world in which there are actually like a lot of women with agency.
I would call her like a Laurie Metcalf type if I had to like sort of type her, but like I like the way that her character Darlene is sort of this little mirror with Laura Linney's character, and the way in which these like that couple, the Snells, who are like, you know, opium growers and dealers, are a reflection of, you know, the birds who we are supposed to be rooting for, who are criminals, but not quite criminals yet, but maybe this is their future sort of thing. And I really do, I liked Lisa Emery's performance a lot, in that. And it's funny because like, I want to loop it back to Laura Linney and say, I think this show doesn't work without Laura Linney in it. Even though there are so many great parts around her. And I'm just fascinated by what she's doing, especially as you say in season two, as she kind of gets like a taste for what she's doing, because it makes me think of like her performance in Mystic River, where she plays this like Lady Macbeth figure, which is just not at all, I think, what you think of for Laura Linney.
Right. Yeah.
And that's her sort of leading hard into that role. And she's great in that film. Obviously.
Well, her Boston accent could use some work, but yes. the emotion shines through.
Everyone's Boston accent in that
movie. Is that my daughter in there?
but this is her doing that geared back a lot. And yeah. I appreciate it even more.
And she does it, yeah. Here. She rolls out. Like, you get to know Wendy in increments that are really, like, I mean, obviously the writing, but, like, Linney's performance just kind of, like, just meets, you know, information and sort of reveals new things at a really nice pace. And that really only gets better in the second season, once I think, you know, they're really figuring out who that character is. Yeah, it's a great performance. There are times when I'm honestly like, she's too good for this, you know, not that the material isn't good, but like, you know, it's Laura fucking Linney, like, you know, but you know, she seems to enjoy it and she's great on it. And I agree that the show would not be nearly what it is. And I probably would not have been really that compelled to even give it a shot, had she not been involved.
There you go. Well, that is our love letter to Laura Linney and our, you know, sort of explanation why we are still watching Ozark. You can, like I said, check out the first two seasons, the only two seasons so far, over on Netflix. You can decide whether or not you want to root for Jason Bateman in either the actor or directing category. Also, Daniel Sackheim, who's a great TV director, is also nominated for directing an episode. The last thing I'll say that I really like about Ozark is at the beginning of every episode, you know, this O pops up on the screen and then you get like four little drawings that are like teasing what's to come, and I think it is like the most fun way to say like this week on Ozark, because you don't see anything and you don't know really until the episode's over what exactly those drawings were nodding towards, but it's always fun to like look at them and be like, okay, I'll remember, okay, it's a boat on fire and there's a broken TV, and I'll remember when those things happen in the show. So
that's and like ominously they'll be like, why is there an axe? Oh god, there's an axe, like someone's gonna get an axe, you know. Like,
exactly.
You know, it's a cute little quirk.
Yeah. All right. Well, Richard, we will be back next week to talk about another fall TV show. In the meantime, where can people find you?
Well, they can find me wandering the banks of Lake Ontario because I am in Toronto for the film festival. But also they can find me on VF.com where I will be reviewing things from the Toronto Film Festival. I will also be on Twitter at Rylaws. How about you?
I am on Twitter at Jerothis. You will find me on VanityFair.com. You'll find us talking about fall film festival season, both of us, over on Little Gold Men, and we will see you next week.
I'm Claire Fallon.
And I'm Emma Gray. We're culture writers, podcasters, and hosts of the show Love to See It.
Every week, we give an unapologetically feminist dissection of reality dating shows, rom-coms, and other romance narratives. We unpack all the weird messages they send us about love, sex, and dating.
And we dive into all the details with special guests like actors, authors, and cultural critics.
You can find Love to See It wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop every Tuesday.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
It looks like they were poisoned. There's no reason Julian would do something like this. He's a 13-year-old boy.
What did you do to your parents?
They died.
He's so far beyond anything you can understand.
It wasn't so.
Something might have happened to us. Why did you change your story?
Hello, and welcome to Still Watching The Sinner, brought to you by USA Network. I'm Emma Stefanski, the weekend editor for Vanity Fair.
And I'm Matt Singer, the editor of ScreenCrush.com.
We're here today to talk about parts 4, 5, and 6 of the second season of The Sinner, which airs on USA on Wednesdays at 10 p.m. Eastern. These three episodes have expanded the show's story in a huge way, but at the center of it remains Natalie Paul's detective character, Heather. Later in the episode, we'll talk to her about her role in this unfolding drama. But first, let's recap these episodes. A lot has happened.
A lot has happened.
We've had flashbacks, we've had dreams, we've had, like, Minotaur references.
Labyrinths, Minotaurs. Yeah. I got this weird Y tattooed on my wrist, and I don't know why.
So let's, I guess, start with episode 4, which has a lot of the, it like, introduces that labyrinth thing, kind of. But we've got a lot of flashbacks to Ambrose as a child, that mysterious fire that seems like his mom started, but probably not. Oh, and Julian asks Ambrose to be his lawyer in this episode because he thinks that Ambrose is the only person who knows who can, like, get him out of this horrible, like, juvenile detention center where all the people are way bigger than he is. And so Ambrose goes to Mosswood and visits Vera, and they visit the rock, and the rock is, like, it ends up sort of being just a rock that was there on the land when they got the land. And
Different religions have associated different meanings with it throughout history.
Yeah. And in this case, they have this weird labyrinth that appears when you connect the lines and dots of this, like, wide tattoo that's on people's arms.
Mm-hmm.
And so we flash back to Marin yet again, and we meet this new character named Lionel Jeffries, who's this, like, cult leader, who's the guy who's kind of come up with all this stuff about the work and like finding your inner self and whatever, which turns pretty creepy. And we see
he's got a lot of good ideas.
What
takes a turn? Yeah. Takes a little bit of a turn.
We see some video footage of a man like beating up someone he was working with.
Yes, the work. There's a lot of talk about the work, which is the therapy that they do, which is, it's more Fight Club than therapy, really, once you get down to it. And it's all being engineered by this mysterious Lionel Jeffries character, who we don't really see at first. Like, right. We don't see much of him in this episode. And, you know, conspiracy theorizing me was like, ooh, who is this mysterious Lionel Jeffries guy? Could Heather's dad be Lionel Jeffries?
Maybe? I thought it was Vera's pen name at first. I thought that she had written a bunch of these books.
Right, because he's written books, including, I have them written down, Escaping the Labyrinth, The Return to Ritual.
Of course.
And my favorite, Inhabiting Our Animal Bodies by Connecting to Nature.
A classic.
Yes, a bestseller on, on the New York Times, for sure. So we don't really see that much of him. Then he becomes more of a character In the next couple of episodes, which sort of, I guess, put the kibosh on my crazy theory. But we can talk more about theories later. I'm sorry to interrupt. But I like Lionel Jeffries. I don't like him, but he's a fascinating character.
I feel like if I met him, I would probably like him. Like, he's one of those characters who's very, like, friendly, and he seems to know what he's talking
about.
Right,
well, that's kind of how cult leaders are. They're not very good at their job if they can't convince you to join their weird, crusade.
And so while Ambrose is visiting Vera and like trying to get her to tell him what this work is, he gets lost in the woods. And then he ends up at this cabin that ended up being Lionel Jeffries' cabin.
Right. While he was there, he's now gone under mysterious circumstances.
He's not with us anymore.
Everything in this show is under mysterious circumstances. They could call this show Under Mysterious Circumstances. But he's gone. He was the Beacon, though. That was his other.
Oh, that's right. It was his name. That was his name. They kept saying the Beacon, the Beacon. And I thought it was like this weird spirit or something from The Rock. But no, it was just a guy. And then I think there's another flashback to Julian.
Well, they start doing the work.
Right.
Vera and Ambrose. And then there's.
She gets really heated.
Yes. More than I was comfortable with. I did say I did want more of the weird.
That's true. You got your wish.
Weird,
kind of
sexy stuff from the first season. I got more than I bargained for. And then he blacks out and wakes up in the hotel where the murders that started this whole thing took place. And he doesn't know how he got there. And he's in the room.
He's in the room
where the murders, not just the hotel, but the exact room. And it's like, is it a message? Is it what is going on? And that's how that episode ends.
I found it so weird. I think this happens, this is cleared up in episode 5, but when he talks to the guy who like owns the motel, the guy was like, yeah, you asked for that room. I thought it was weird that he would just give him that room again.
You want the murder room? Here you go.
Like, oh, yeah, let's let you
maybe,
revisit
well,
this trauma.
Maybe it's discounted because of all the murder.
Right.
No one wants to stay in the murder room, so it was the only room available.
You have to disclose to your
maybe
like,
it's cheaper. Who knows? So yeah, that when the next episode begins, we see like security camera footage of Ambrose is like just walking around. Like it's not like he was like drugged and dropped there.
He seemed fine, which is even creepier.
But he has no memory of what happened,
right?
Which yes is way creepier.
So he immediately like confronts Vera and is like, "You did something to me." And she's like very weirded out by the fact that he has no memory of what happened. She's like, "I didn't give you anything. This is strange." Which I don't know if that was legit or if she's just being creepy again.
Eventually, the sort of investigation begins to involve more of this other previously much more tangential character, Glenn Fisher.
That's right.
And
the, like, was he a cop?
He's one of the, I guess you would say, the glitterati of the town.
He's a
but
celebrity.
Yes. As it turns out, he has this past with Mosswood.
His family owned the land.
They owned the land. His grandfather, Howard Fisher, and Ambrose, snooping around in his house without a warrant, I believe.
Right.
Finds all this evidence, you know, finds a picture of the big rock, finds out that Howard Fisher, the grandfather, owned the land since the 1930s, gave it to or sold it to Lionel Jeffries in the 90s. And there's also in flashbacks, there's a lot of stuff involving like scapegoating.
Yes.
An actual cow, an animal is ritualistically slaughtered.
Almost a goat.
Yeah. It's a cow instead of a goat, but
it's close.
It's a scape cow. And is adorable, like sweet looking cow that
it's so cute.
The idea is like they're like almost like casting off, it's scapegoating. They're casting off their evil human sins and then killing the animal, as the idea is that now they're free of them or right. some such.
As soon as I saw that cow, I knew something terrible is going to happen to this thing.
Yes.
And we learn that Marin is indeed Julian's mother. Also, Lionel Jeffries is Julian's father.
Yes.
Which seems a little bit suspect.
Right. And then as we get into the sixth episode, well, first of all, we learn, we got a glimpse of Ambrose's driver's license, which included his date of birth, December 17th, 1953. That is Bill Pullman's actual birthday.
Oh, that's funny. That's cool.
Little thing I noticed there. But we got a lot. I mean, that episode was very heavy on flashbacks to Mosswood and also like kind of deepening the character of Vera and mm-hmm. showing you, you know, when she's introduced, she seems like the evil cult leader. And she may still be evil. It's, you know, it's with this show, everyone kind of has, you know, dark sides and secrets they're hiding. But we're seeing a more sort of complicated side, shall right. we say, as it relates to Julian and how she became his sort of adopted mother.
She started out as like practically a recruiter for these people and then ended up getting a little weirded out by how everything was escalating.
Right.
And starting to doubt.
The scape cowing was something she had not signed up for.
No.
And when things turn like actually violent, you know, she says something to along the lines of, you know, our work used to be much more imaginative.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're like actually hurting each other. And she's not really down with that. And so we still don't really know, as this episode ends, what happened to Lionel Jeffries. But there's a very strong suggestion near the end of this episode that that gypsum weed tea, I guess maybe it's a family recipe, because it sure seems like she might have given, she being Vera, might have given Lionel Jeffries. She definitely gave him tea.
She did.
But as to what kind of tea it is, we don't entirely know yet, but the strong suggestion is that it might just be a little bit of that poison tea.
That gypsum weed. Yeah, that stuff is pretty nasty. One thing I did want to talk about was Julian's recurring nightmare that he keeps having of that weird hooded figure standing over him and like at one point reaching its hand like into his stomach, which was really weird. And in episode 4, they introduce this like old hag archetype that's one of the like main archetypal figures that appears in dreams of normal people that normal people have.
Sure.
I've never dreamed about
the old
hag. You
don't have old hag dreams?
I've never had closet door dreams either. I don't know. All of my dreams are like very narrative based. But they like introduce this concept and basically they're like, Julian, this is what's going on. Like, you're dreaming about this weird figure because
right. it's not real.
Yeah.
It's a dream.
It's not reality. It's fine. Like, you got to grow up and get over it. But then at the end of episode 6, we learn that it is not real. It is, in fact, real. This really happened to him. And not only that, the person, whoever it is, seems to have returned and has taken Julian away from the foster home
mm-hmm.
through an open window.
Right.
Which was very frightening. And I had to, I didn't sleep well after watching that.
Did you then have an old hag dream at that point?
I keep trying to like lucid dream the old hag and it's not working.
So what do you have a theory about this?
The two people that it could be are either Lionel Jeffries, who is probably dead.
Right.
Agreed. Or Marin. Because a lot of some of the stuff that the show likes to do is like introduce a character who is at first very sinister and weird, but then you
learn see the
layers. That they're not. And
right.
then alternately a character who seems friendly and then is revealed not to be.
Mm-hmm.
So I think maybe this like scary figure could be Julian's mom returning to him finally.
But then who was the corpse that they find in the car in the lake?
I think it's somebody else.
Oh, you think that's a fake out? It's a red herring. It wouldn't be the most shocking thing that's happened on this show. My thinking was that previously, and forgive me for not watching and paying enough attention to tell you this right off the top of my head, but was thinking that it was a dream.
Mm.
And whoever he told it to, one of the people he told that to, used the dream to bring this dream character to life as a means of
connecting with him,
sneaking into his room and absconding with him. That's my theory, is that it was a dream previously, because to the best of my knowledge, you can't like Temple of Doom
your fingers
into a person's stomach and not leave marks, not, you know what I mean? So that's what I was sort of wondering.
Do you think that of the hooded figures that we've seen, has one been real and not a dream?
Oh, I think the most recent one is real.
Oh, yeah.
But that it's someone he told, because he's told people about this.
He has.
And, you know, Mosswood, word spreads fast over there. So it could be multiple people.
It's a small place.
Right. I mean, I sort of like your idea. Your theory is intriguing, and I want to subscribe to the newsletter. But but I wonder if perhaps both of our theories could be correct. Because the earlier scenes also felt more dreamlike. The time that we saw it previously when the fingers went into the stomach, that felt like a dream.
And you see him like sitting up
and
in
you
bed
see
and
him
up.
Waking up. And this one felt so, it felt like it was shot differently
mm-hmm.
to convey that it was real and it wasn't a dream. So that's why, that's what sort of made me key into it. Now I didn't, and this is where we can bring in my theory from our previous podcast.
I really want to talk about this thing.
Well, sure. I want to hear. I mean, it could be
your expansion.
I mean, theoretically, it could be Heather's dad, because why not? I mean,
it could be.
It could be. All I want to say about that theory, which we discussed more at length in our previous podcast, has not been disproven in any way that he could be evil, part of the cult behind everything. And I feel like everything we've seen in this trio of episodes, to me, is just convincing me more and more. He's always trying to get Heather to put away those maps.
Yeah.
Stop dealing with the case. You need to get your mind off of it. I want to eat ice cream. I'm going back to my weeds. You know, all of these things.
Like weird salads that he like
pours ranch dressing even though she's told him not to. Absolutely. So to me, it's just clue after clue. And I think they're playing it perfectly where they're not giving away their hand.
There's never like a shot where he's like looking.
Right. And he's playing it perfectly. But I don't think there has been a single thing that you could point to say it is not true. It's not possible because of this.
Mm-hmm, that's true.
And, you know, like I was saying, I think before, like I was at when they first started introducing this mysterious Lionel Jeffries who went missing, I was like, ah. It's the dad. He created a new identity to escape the. But now I don't think that's true because we've seen so much of Lionel Jeffries.
Maybe he got like face surgery.
I thought about that
with that cult.
That's how crazy I am. As I was thinking about that, but now I'm not buying that. But I do think he is involved somehow in whether it was maybe the death of the mom and the cult helped him. Mosswood helped him cover it up.
Oh, that would be creepy. That would be really messed up because
it would be very messed
Heather's
up.
Father.
Yes. But we have seen that that Mosswood, you know, that there's a lot of violence and that there's all these sort of people from the community use the cult as a means to sort of get out their anger and all these things. So it might not have even been an intentional murder. It could have been an accident, you know, perhaps in the process of doing the work.
That's what I think it
That's
is.
That's what you think?
That's like the thought that popped into my head while I was watching episode 6 was like, oh, I bet she didn't. No one like killed her because there's no like reason for them to kill her.
Right.
Except like, you know, if Vera wanted to steal her baby, which I don't think even she would do.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I totally think that she died as an accident and they covered it up.
So we can move on to other issues, but I wanted to address because I really put myself out there.
I'm starting to believe you.
Good.
There's no reason not to.
No.
At this point.
Exactly.
We also learned that Ambrose was the one who started the kitchen fire, not his mother. And he
shocking to me.
Get her attention.
Right.
Basically, just like set some curtains on fire.
I mean, I don't know about you, but I didn't find that a particularly shocking twist. It felt like that was sort of where we were going, especially when they're talking about, you know, and then we're starting to get into the ideas about like repressed memories and when Vera's saying, the ego doesn't want you to, you know, bring these things up. It seemed like that was the direction everything was going.
He definitely had like guilt associated with those memories,
yes.
which meant like he was partially responsible for it, even though like, you know, as a child, you think that you're responsible for everything. But In that case, it was true. Mm-hmm. He did it.
We talked a little bit about in the previous episode. I know for sure we did in the first one. I'm not sure about the second one. But the movie references that are sort of scattered throughout.
That's
and
right.
I picked up a few more. We already talked about the Fisher King, which, yeah, I guess it could be about
huge
a legend.
Fan.
But obviously, I thought about the movie. But
you
the
mentioned
one,
M, I think, in episode one.
In episode one, yeah. Yeah. And in this one, or in this group of episodes, I got a real strong Apocalypse Now vibe from the slaughtering of the cow.
There's
very similar stuff in Apocalypse Now, which
the
is also
cow.
Has sort of this very charismatic leader in this sort of commune environment. And then all the stuff with dredging the car up from the lake is the last shot of Psycho. And there were previous Psycho allusions too with the motel and the
right.
murder and the
right.
shower. And so there's almost like a remix of Psycho going on here. All the issues with mother guilt. You know, the corpses, the bones, the desiccated bones is very much like the, you know, poor old mother from Psycho. Spoiler alert for a 65-year-old movie,
right.
but there you have it. So, yeah, those were the two big ones that I spotted in these episodes.
What do you think about all this stuff with, like, Julian? Julian is this special boy. He's this, like, people keep saying, like, Vera said, you know, you have no idea, like, what he is. You have no idea. And then Lionel Jeffries at one point is like, he will bind us together or something. I think like mainly he was talking about how a child of the commune would be a nice thing for everyone. But
I thought mainly he wanted to scape cow, scape human. He was going to, you know.
Maybe that's how it escalated. Like it went
that was
too
the,
far.
That
then,
was what I that's what I thought is that that he was going to scape baby. And that was the final straw for Vera. That was my thinking. I mean, I will say I would like to see in the last two episodes coming up, I'd like to see more of Julian because he is such an interesting character.
He's great.
And I think he almost has to remain a mystery because, you know, he is the center of the mystery of like, why did he presumably kill these two people and what does it have to do with this whole swirling conspiracy around him? So we can't know that much until we sort of answer all those questions. But I feel like he is the character that I want to see more of because of those reasons that you're mentioning. Like, how is he special and how did being raised in this environment make him this way? And, you know, we get to see him in the prison a little bit, but I felt like, you know, I want to see more. I thought of all the characters and the potential for more interesting stuff in the final couple of episodes, I feel like he's top of the list. I want to see more of him. And, you know, I guess when we find out who took him out of that, you know,
right.
boys' home, that'll probably be a good place to throw some of that in. But I'm definitely looking forward to seeing more of him.
On the line, we have Natalie Paul, who plays Heather Novak in this season of The Sinner. How are you?
I'm great. I'm great. I'm in New York. It feels good to have wrapped the show. I still can't quite believe it because it was like, okay, it feels like we just, you know, it just started.
We have two more episodes to go in this season. Is there
two more episodes? Okay, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, 7 and 8. Is there? I guess no spoilers, but is there anything coming up that you're like really excited for people to see?
Yeah, definitely. I can't talk about it. You know, I think, you know, honestly, I think you just, I don't know, I can't really say much.
All right,
I think I can just say that, yeah, it's going to be good.
That's all we need
really
to
good.
Hear. Do you have a favorite scene from, like, the 6 episodes that we've seen? Like, did you, well, while you were watching it, were you like, oh yeah, this was really, really cool to shoot?
I loved shooting the breakup scene with Marin at the gate.
That
was really, it was just nice. You know, I actually loved shooting all the Marin scenes, all the flashback scenes, because present day Heather, I don't know I'd be friends with, to be honest with you. But flashback Heather, she had at least she knew how to have a little fun, you know. So I really enjoyed like just not being in the uniform and just relating and having, you know, being able to talk to, you know, act with Hannah and have these authentic moments of friendship, of female friendship, and just revisiting that time of life. But definitely the breakup for both of us, I think, as actors, it was really challenging and good to do. And I just really had a good time that day, I remember.
I know with us, when we're sitting here talking about it, we love to like break down, you know, some of the themes you've been talking about, but we also like, you know, trying to figure out, oh, is this person going to be in on it? Is this person secretly part of the cult? Are, when you're not shooting, when you're on set, are you guys playing those same games, trying to like figure it out before you get that next script?
Yeah, definitely. We were sort of a little bit. I think part of us were like, how is this all going to come together? Because, I mean, you know, just everybody, like it feels, even though it's definitely, you know, Bill's show and it's, you know, we're going to see Detective Ambrose again in the next seasons and stuff. It still felt like such a collaborative environment. And so we were just all very much curious about how this all was going, like, how is this going to relate, you know? Like, when are we going to have a scene together? When are you and I going to have a scene together, you know? Mm-hmm. And what's going to happen in that scene, you know? So, and I love that about the show, by the way, is that it's very taut, like, in a sense of, like, you know, yes, we see the town and there's all kinds of characters that we meet, but before I was on The Deuce, and that was such a big cast. It was a huge cast, and I definitely ended up seeing how it was all connected in the end. But during, you know, with The Sinner, it felt a bit more like a play, as close to a play that it can feel like, because of the fact that it was sort of so centralized and just the connections are being made in every episode. So that was really cool.
Did anyone have like a fan theory that you guys were like, oh my God, this is totally true, and then it ended up not being
a fan theory? Oh, you mean like a theory on the show?
Yeah.
Oh, you mean, oh, the moment when like Heather becomes a part of Mosswood and, you know, finds Moran and they create a new Mosswood campus, like that one?
That sounds great.
They take Mosswood International. We were joking so much that I honestly can't remember, because, you know, we would just find all kinds of reasons to come up with stuff, but there's one.
I really want that to happen. I mean, I'm sure it won't happen, but that would be so cool.
Thank you so much for having me.
No, you've been great. Thank you for calling in. And that's it for this week's episode of Still Watching The Sinner.
Join us again next Sunday, September 16th, after Still Watching. Joanna and Richard will be discussing the Amazon series Jack Ryan, and we'll be discussing episode 7 of The Sinner. This episode was edited and produced by Brandon Harrison.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness, really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Want to stay up to date on the biggest stories in pop culture and entertainment? Then be sure to check out the TMZ podcast. I'm Charlie Cotton from TMZ, the TV show, and every day I'll sit down with a member of our news team to give exclusive breakdowns of the day's most talked about headlines. stories we break, and the stories you care about. So check out the TMZ podcast, Monday through Friday, and the other podcasts from the TMZ Audio Network, like Last Days and TMZ Verified, available on all podcast platforms.